Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the CEOs, clinicians, founders, journalists, investors that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself called PocDoc. PocDoc and our flagship product, the Healthy Heart Check, is revolutionizing how people can keep track of their cardiovascular health. It lets you get the equivalent of an NHS health check in 10 minutes at home or anywhere that you want to happen to do it. I actually do mine in between meetings. Here gives you a full cholesterol panel, your heart age, and your overall cardiovascular risk score. If you want more information, head to PocDoc.co, but we're also on sale at Well pharmacies across the country and at Pharmacy to You. So thank you very much to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you also, I always say this, but thank you to everyone who's listening live right now on UK Health Radio. The numbers for the show keep going up and up, so we must be doing something that you like. So really appreciate you guys tuning in. Thank you if you're listening on the podcast channel of your choice. Really appreciate that. We now have downloads from over 50 countries every single month, which is wild. And thank you if you're watching this either as a short on my Instagram, which is at Steve Roost, or on our YouTube channel. So anyway, that's all of the thank yous out the way. Last week's show, if you missed it, was with Nora Cavani, who is the founder of Alba Health. This was a really interesting show on the children gut microbiome. So if you're into microbiome stuff, Alba is the only company in the world that has access to a really unique data set that means it can basically analyze your child's poo and determine how to prevent them getting allergies and all kinds of other chronic diseases. Super interesting. They're really well funded and Nora's a really compelling founder. So check that show out. On to today's show. Today's show is a very special show for me because we've got someone on the show that I've known for probably just over 20 years, I would estimate by this point. He's had an unbelievable career, done an unbelievable number of inspiring things, and it's brilliant to be able to kind of bring things together to do the show with him. So my guest today is a fella called Sean Stafford. So he's a two-time WBFF Men's Physique Champion. He's a founder and entrepreneur of a really successful chain of gyms called City Athletic. Sean was one of the first early people that I can remember before there were influencers as an influencer. Like, I remember when we just left university, Sean was already blowing up on Facebook and things like that. And he's also friends with Spencer Matthews and partook in Spencer Matthews' journey across the desert, where Spencer did all kinds of crazy marathons in a ridiculous number of days. Sean's also a UK representative for Ghost Lifestyle, which, if you're into that, that's a very, very popular drinks and athletic brand. And he happens to be an Arsenal fan. So, Sean, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, mate. What an introduction.
Yeah.
You massively dated us when you said he blew up on Facebook, because that instantly puts us in the old man category.
If you want to, you can edit that out before you put it out on your channels where you're pretending to be younger. That's okay.
It's great. Yeah, we can't face tune the audio.
No, you can't. Anyway, look, there's so much I kind of want to cover with you, because I know that you're in an evolved, you've always been, I think even when we were at university together, health was a really big thing for you, right? Fitness was a really big thing. And I guess I want to just start to try and understand, where did that come from? Because was that something that you always had, or did that start at some point in your childhood or young adulthood? Like, what was the initial kind of drive for that?
I've always been a very sort of sporty and active person ever since I was a kid. My dad, who's a military man, used to take me out running regularly. He used to play a lot of sport. I used to play a lot of sport with him in the garden, and it kind of started then and evolved into more team-based sports through school and university. And then after university, kind of went down the route of, you know, getting really into the gym. Actually, you probably remember the time when you were there when I discovered the weight room. So it was in that it was in that time between our first and second year at uni,
yeah,
when I went away quite a skinny guy and came back a bit of a behemoth.
You were quite cultish. You were like a whippet, a lean greyhound frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I went from being pretty skinny, whippet-esque, sort of amateur level rugby player to being a bit of a gym monster in the space of about a year. And it all happened because when I started playing sort of rugby at university, they told me that I better hit the weights room, otherwise I'm going to get killed. And so I took that as motivation to go and join a gym. And I started working in a gym and got into weight training, and that whole process kind of changed my life.
And like, did you know when that was happening that your life was like being changed? Because you embraced it. You didn't just kind of, you went all in on it, right? You then became a founder of a gym and a internationally gold medalist in this particular thing. I mean, like, when did that transition start to happen?
I think when I obviously, when I was playing rugby, it was going to the gym was kind of to support that. But probably halfway through our second year at university, I actually probably started to enjoy going to the gym more than I enjoyed playing rugby. And it was one of those ones where just leaning into that feeling of knowing what you're actually enjoying kind of allowed me to build up my sort of training age in the gym. But also, it's what I was fascinated by. It's what really kind of turned me on. Right. As much as, you know, I loved playing team sport, it was one of those things where that pursuit of a physique and physical prowess and that training journey, that sort of day in, day out controlled progression, it was really enlightening for me. And I think it laid the foundations to sort of not only grow my physique and grow my body, but also to help structure my mind, which, you know, as a young man, can be all over the place, right? Yeah. There's a lot of things pulling you in a lot of different directions. And I think the routine and control and sort of discipline of a weights room and a gym really helped steer me and kind of shape me into the guy that I am today.
Because some people, I that I we can. There's so much in there I want to pick up on as we go through. But some people, how do you? Because I've had this myself. Like I've always been in around sports in some way, shape, or form. And I've sort of sometimes I've been in the weights room, sometimes I've not. I've never managed to get to the point where you got to where it became so interesting in and of itself, like that controlled progression. Like, did you have to force it, or did it just happen naturally?
I think, and this is where there's a little bit of nature versus nurture, right? I think naturally I'm quite gifted when it comes to this journey. I think, you could probably take 10 people and put us all on that same journey, and I would probably come out in the top one or two of those 10. I think just, the gene pool soup that my parents gave me kind of, set me up for a level of success in the sport. I responded very well to the stimulus of training, but I also had the discipline to be able to bring that level of consistency to training, but also to kind of dig deep into the science of it. I wasn't just going in there and, throwing a couple of weights around. I kind of, don't get me wrong, I did it first. I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but the more I got into it, the more educated and nuanced I found out that weight training and particularly progressive overload and strength conditioning training over time, how nuanced that is and how scientific it is. And then just, getting into the skill of cultivating your own programs that, ensure that you're every time you're getting into the gym, you're going to be better than you were yesterday. And it's that long-term sort of play that kind of really fascinated me.
And when what was the so just for we're a bit of a broad church, but I don't know how many people will intuitively know what the WBFF Men's Physique World Championships is, but could you give us a bit of enlightenment just as to what that is and some context? Because it's obviously it's not bodybuilding, but it's in the same universe, right?
It's absolutely in the same universe. So kind of when I finished playing rugby after uni, I was in that no man's land of not really having a goal to train for. And probably most people can relate to this, that it's a horrible place to be because you really want to have that, reason to go and put yourself through the discomfort and the pain and all that good stuff that comes with training. And so a friend of mine in the gym I was working at basically said, "Hey, there's this new thing called men's physique. I think we should enter it. And I think we do really well at it, and it'll give us something to train for." And this was kind of, it was back in the early 2010s, 2011s, where it was really, really big in the United States, but not super big over here in the UK and Europe. So I thought, yeah, why not give this a try? So dieted and trained really hard for 3 or 4 months, entered a show, and ended up winning my category at the first time of asking. And that kind of lit the touch
Lit the
paper and
fuse.
got me really, really interested in it, really engaged in it. And then, with that one, I got an entry to the European Championships, which was sort of 6 to 7 months later. So I, took a couple of months off and then went again, ended up winning that sort of European Championships, and not only got a pro card, which is basically means that you then can compete on the pro circuit, but I got an invitation to the World Championships, which was
Nice.
in Toronto, Canada, sort of 9 months after that.
Okay.
So that's kind of when I was like, okay, this I could potentially be pretty good at this.
Right.
I,
Yeah,
you know,
maybe
I'm,
this is a thing.
yeah, I'm in the mix. But it was also one of those things where at the time it was still pretty underground. Like a lot of people that go to the gym knew about it, but it definitely wasn't mainstream by any stretch of the imagination. So then again, fast forward 6 to 9 months, and I was in the best shape I've ever been in. Got up on stage with 60 odd other competitors that were all professional, all representing, similar to how many people tune into your podcast. There was like 50 different nationalities on stage. And I ended up winning that competition at the first time of asking. So went from being a pretty broke rugby player to being a world champion professional bodybuilder as such in a very, very short period of time in 18 months.
And did you then like do the circuit to whatever extent that is, or were you sort of like, so you went around all the various different shows all over the world, or like, what did that look like?
Exactly. It was, do you know what? If you've played team sport before, it was probably the closest thing to team sport in that sort of category, in that kind of sport, because you're competing against the same people every, month in, month out. You're all talking, you're all training together. It's the camaraderie within the federation was something that was really fun.
Oh, that's
And it was,
cool.
yeah, it was at a time of your life when you're young, you're just,
Just having fun.
the world is your oyster, and you're a bit like a Formula One driver, flying into Iceland or flying into Milan or flying into Toronto or going down to the Gold Coast in
Oh, that's
Australia. You know,
awesome.
you're kind of traveling the world doing something that you enjoy. With the backset or the backdrop of like competitive sport. So
And
it was a really fun time.
it's cool that you guys all got on because you never know behind the scenes, right? Like it could be really, I don't know, snarky. I'm not allowed to swear on the show, but I was going to say something else. But really like niggly, but everyone was okay.
So I think the one of the great things about the WBFF, which was the kind of federation that I competed with, they were very big on camaraderie. They were very big on what you're like off stage is as important as what you're like on stage.
Oh, that's
And that,
cool.
yeah, they're essentially saying that you are ambassadors for our brand as well as your brand. So if you're a bit of a tool, you won't be welcome. So it's one of those ones where, don't get me wrong, I think if left unchecked, the potential for people to be not so kind to each other would be there. But I also think that when you're with a group of guys and a group of girls that are all kind of aligned and training for the same thing and that same pursuit of excellence, that you have so many shared experiences that you have more in common than you have to be sort of antagonistic about.
That makes sense. And what was the transition from that into like launching the gym chain and that kind of piece of it? Because did you
It
feel like
all
that was like a natural extension or like was that?
kind of happened at the same time, actually.
Oh,
So
really?
there was this period over about 2 years, 18 months, 2 years, where I'd kind of won the European Championships and was on my way to my first World Championships. And it was that period where not only was I launching the gym business, but it's kind of when social media was blowing up as well. So it's when my Facebook page was going berserk because I was sort of blogging and documenting all the stuff that I was doing. And all three things were kind of running in parallel from about 2010 onwards.
Because
So it was one of those ones.
you were like really at the forefront of this kind of like personal branding stuff that's now is how people make loads of money just doing personal branding. But you, like you said, you were just documenting it as you kind of went along.
It was one of those ones where I just remember starting a Facebook page and then just on your phone, just recording your workouts as you were doing it and recording what you were eating. And then, it, of course, it's designed to keep you engaged with the platform, but it did its job. Like it really motivated me to keep going because I sort of had what started off as 1,000 people as accountability partners quickly grew to 100,000 people, quickly grew to 1 million. So it was one of those ones
Did you get
where,
up to 1 million on Facebook?
I got up to 1 million. I think by the time I won my first world championships, I think probably a month or two after that, I hit a million subscribers on Facebook.
Wow, that is
Yeah.
mental.
It's crazy. Yeah,
That's
it's
bonkers.
crazy. And
Did
what it
you?
means, and in reality, what it means is you can pretty much walk into any gym on the planet and somebody will recognize you,
Is that,
which
do you still
was,
get that now, or you got that at the time?
less relevance now, which is quite nice. I kind of like being behind the camera now rather than the front of it. But yeah, there was a time when I could go into a gym anywhere in the world and chances are somebody would come over and say hi, which was great. Yeah, which was really
That's
fun.
cool. That is interesting. And so like the gym thing, how much of a risk did that feel like at the point when you were doing it with all this other stuff? Like how did you assess it? Like how did it happen?
I think it was one of those ones where I'd worked in gyms for probably 5 years by that point. And, for anyone that's a gym goer in central London, there's lots of things that you probably dislike about the gym and that are major barriers to it becoming a consistent, enjoyable part of your day-to-day life. And I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine at the time who was one of my mentors. And he was like, we should set up our own gym where we can remove all of this rubbish that we don't like about working in big commercial gyms. And I said, well, you know, let's do a business plan. We know enough people that are quite minted. Let's see if any of our clients want to chip in and support us on this, because it'll be a better experience for them as well. Right. And we just sat down and we just did a business plan, raised some capital, and then got the process going. And I think within about a year, we had our first site, and then it was all systems go. And I'll be honest with you, we kind of just made it up as we went along. we'd all worked in gyms for for probably a decade by that time, give or take.
Right.
And it was just one of those things where we had an idea of how we wanted it to work. So we just set out on the mission to make it and to almost will it into reality.
I love that. And so so we're all on the same page, what are the things that suck about gyms in London in general that your sort of overcame?
So one of them was probably the most common persistent complaint that we would get working in commercial gyms is that they're overcrowded.
Okay.
Is that the gym membership model is, you know, they try and rack them and stack them and fill the spaces so full that at a lunchtime or in the morning before work or after work, it'd be so busy you wouldn't be able to get on any of the equipment.
Right.
And as a trainer working in that environment, when you've, you know, if you're into the science of training and you're into the progression of training, you want your clients to be following a plan.
Yep.
And you walk into a gym at 6 p.m. at night with your client and this perfectly crafted plan, and all of a sudden everything you wanted to use is out. Someone is on it. And so it was one of those ones where it just became unworkable. And so what we did as one of our big USPs was to cap our memberships so that we only ever had 400 members of a gym. You go into a normal commercial gym in central London, probably they're looking at 4,000 members.
Is that because they know that people won't show up? How does that model work? I don't know.
It's a case of they get people to sign up and hope they don't come.
Yeah, whereas right. It's inverse, right?
Yeah. Whereas we sign people up and hope they do come.
Yeah.
So it's one of those ones, because we, you know, our second biggest revenue stream behind membership, and they're probably very much one-on-one, is personal training revenue. So we have a team of unbelievable expert trainers who train train at least 50% of our members at any one time. Right. So if you look at the penetration of personal training on a national level in most commercial gyms, it's sitting anywhere between 5% and 6%, whereas we look at somewhere nearer 50%. So it's a different proposition.
So you're like 10x the average.
Yeah, 10x the average. And it was kind of, at the time, it was ahead of its time. Now it's quite commonplace, the sort of stuff that we were doing.
Okay.
You know, so we were capping our memberships. We were having elite level coaches. We were having proper sort of strength and conditioning facilities that were, at the time, kind of the exclusive right of professional athletes. But we thought, let's see if we can make all of this cool tech and all of these cool things open to the public. And they'll have to pay a little bit more to use them, but their experience will be so much better. And we thought there are enough people in central London that don't mind paying a little bit more to have a much, much more elevated experience. And that was kind of our mantra when we were creating the business. It was, let's get really, really good staff. Let's make sure the equipment is top of the line. Let's make sure the community element of it is really up there. Let's make sure it's the basics, clean and tidy.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be able to eat my dinner off the floor
I've been into some gritty gyms in my time, and you're like, this is it's not great.
So we just kind of wanted to remove all of those things and create a space that was different and really geared up to putting a focus on member experience and sort of also trainer experience, so that we could retain and sort of keep happy, like a really strong core of excellent trainers.
Cool. And it's called City Athletic, right? Still called City
Yeah,
Athletic.
still called City Athletic. Yeah.
Cool. Well, we're going to go for our first commercial break because my producer is sort of, you know,
waving at you.
Subtly indicating that we're over time. So we will be right back with the second part of today's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Sean Stafford, who's the CEO of City Athletic and all-time health legend. So we'll be back. We'll be back after 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Indecision. Overthinking. Second guessing every choice you make. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Beige on beige on beige. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Sean Stafford, who's CEO of City Athletic, health influencer, representative of many health brands, and I've known him for 20 years since we went to university together. So, Sean, I want to kind of switch the conversation up now a little bit to talk about the stuff that you've been doing recently, or well, more than recently, in and around men's health. So I know that you're a big ambassador, big advocate in and around this space. Like, how did you start to really focus, other than being a man obviously and being into health, like how, at what point did you sort of start to become more vocal or more interested about being vocal about this type of thing?
I think in having spent 20 years as a coach predominantly dealing with men, right? So, you know, when I was a personal trainer working in the gyms and working in my gyms, I would predominantly deal with men, and there was always this sort of conversation in play around men and this want and need to be healthy, but then also the real struggle for us to tick all the boxes. And something that I kind of put two and two together with, you know, a couple of years ago, was that it's often the pressure that we feel to fill all the buckets at all times that is the biggest burden on most men. Mm. And I thought, let's start talking about that, because it's, you know, a problem shared is a problem halved in most cases. And sometimes men just want to be heard. Mm. They don't necessarily, you know, we're pretty good at fixing our own problems and fixing everyone else's problems. So sometimes we just need to be heard. And a lot of the time there wasn't really a space for that.
Mm.
And so I started a podcast pre-COVID called The Dad Podcast.
By the way, best podcast title ever, yeah, I think.
I thought it was so. Pretty epic. I think I still have it.
I thought that was on point when I saw that. I was like, oh, snap, that's a good one.
And it kind of just evolved to that. It kind of just evolved into a couple of series where I would get, you know, men who are in, you know, involved in health, fitness, wellness, well-being, and talk about the things that they're struggling with, talk about the pressures they're feeling, talk about how they get through them, talk about how they optimize their lives. And it was just a really nice, authentic conversation that I was having, really, both online through the you know, the medium of podcast, but also on a day-to-day basis with the people I was coming into contact with at my gyms. And it kind of, it wasn't necessarily a conscious effort that I made or a you know, flag I drove into the ground. It was just something that quite naturally happened. And then I started working with a men's health brand called Manual, who basically a friend of mine set up a business just before COVID. And it was sort of blood testing and testosterone replacement therapy for men. And they got acquired by Manual. And as part of that acquisition, there was a conversation where, because I was involved in the early stages of the other business, they said, look, would you be interested in coming on and being a mouthpiece for what we're trying to talk about and what we're trying to share and the message we're trying to bring to the majority of men? I said, absolutely. It felt really authentic. It felt really clear and sort of crystallized around me hosting a podcast for them.
Yeah.
And it's just a place that I still really enjoy being. It's still, I think men like to have conversations that aren't always about woe. I think they quite like to have it with a bit of fun. They like to have it with a bit of fun. They like to have it with a bit of banter, but also they don't just want to be bombarded with men's mental health all the time. They want to hear about ice baths. They want to hear about fasting. They want to hear about clean eating. They want to hear about progressive resistance. They want to hear about how to get your 5K time down. They don't, but at the same time, the conversation around depression, anxiety, having a support network, it's not off limits. Nothing's off limits. So we kind of built up a really nice community and a really nice ecosystem around the Men Emmanuel podcast.
Yeah,
Something that I've
which is another good name, by the way. I don't know if you can take credit for that, but I thought that was
That's not
another good one.
me.
That's a
That's
good
not me.
one, though.
That's not me.
Yeah. How often does it go out? How often do you do shows?
So we usually do a socials first strategy. So the aim is to produce sort of 1 to 2 long format sort of shows a month, usually filmed on the same day. And then from those, we kind of harvest and mine a load of sort of shorter, more informative bits for social media, mainly TikTok, Instagram, that
Makes
sort of stuff,
sense.
YouTube
The
shorts.
ones I saw on Instagram, I saw this before we sorted out you coming on the show. So the stuff I and this is what I thought was really impressive. So on our show, we've done all kinds of different things. We've done menopause, period tracking, erectile dysfunction. We've done all kinds of different things, and we don't have any issue talking about any of that stuff. And it was the same. I saw that you did one on erectile dysfunction. You did one on penis size. You did what I can't remember what the other one I saw was, but it was exactly what you said, which is I think it's probably difficult to get a bunch of guys in a room and talk about penis size without there being a bit of banter and joking. Like I don't, you know what I mean? I think it would be fake if everyone was sat around like solemnly talking about that, you know? But it felt like weirdly, it felt kind of natural in the way that you guys sort of set that one up. I thought it was good.
And it's also I think you'll know this, that the success of the show is really down to the sort of generosity of the guests. And a lot of the time, like, we got to work with, Dr. Anand Patel is, on Channel 4's Embarrassing Body, and he's an absolute firecracker. Like, he just says whatever pops into his head, and he's such a funny, like, genuine person who's also a doctor, right? So
That
it
helps.
kind of it, yeah it
But
all
yeah.
it all you know he's a GP, and he's a sexual health and men's health clinician. And for him to be able to tackle it with a smile and with laughter and with humor kind of breaks down that almost sort of turgid barrier to men's health that I think a lot of men struggle with. They go to their GPs and they don't want to talk about, they've got a lump on their testicles, or they've got blood in their stool, or they're no longer attracted to their wife and they don't know why, or they can't think straight anymore, or there's a lot of things that men have to deal with. And a lot of it, there is a huge amount of stigma wrapped around. And I think, if we can tackle that with a bit of humor and really normalize it, because 90% of men are going to be going through the same things.
Yeah, at some
And
point anyway.
I think it's one of those things where a lot of people, when they back themselves into a hole, they think they're alone. And they think that, that they're the only ones that are suffering with this. And by all accounts, they suffer in silence. And I think if we can have those conversations and make more people aware that they're not on their own and that they don't have to suffer in silence, then I think men's health as a general category will be much better off.
I agree with you. And do you think this is like for all of the stuff that gets thrown at social media about the bad sides, do you think this type of thing is one of the areas of clear benefit, which is to be able to communicate in a way in which the community will engage with and accept and listen to?
Yeah, I think the one of the issues I see with social media today is that it is so polarizing and divisive. So I think when you're looking at the algorithms that are, working in the background to keep people engaged, it usually makes you either really, really support something or really, really against something. It's so polarizing that it's designed to drive engagement and almost fury. And I think, and I think, And I think we operate in a space that's probably slightly more nuanced and therefore probably isn't so accessible via the social platforms. I think, you know, we have to work really hard to try and
get
be creative.
Yeah.
Be creative and find ways of,
oh, that's
of
interesting.
Hacking the algorithms. And it's, I don't want to use the word clickbait because I think that's a bit reductive, but it's one of those things where you have to try and find ways to make quite serious, quite complicated, often quite nuanced topics really easily accessible and fun.
Yes.
Which sometimes are just not.
No, I mean, exactly. No, that's, do you know what? That's a really interesting point of view, which I'd not really considered, which is, I mean, not to the same extent you guys, but I've sort of seen it myself in different ways where content that you think is really informative just completely bombs. But because it doesn't fit with the eyeballs algorithm concept. But it could be really useful. And then you've got other content which is completely off the wall nutso and not true. And, and I'm talking about like medical stuff, which isn't true, can just go like the clappers. And there doesn't seem to be any way to kind of rein that in.
I think that's where, and it's something that when I look at social strategy, I think picking your platform is a really key advantage that we kind of, you know, we have our own patterns and habits as a steer on it. So if you're looking for informative content, chances are you're not going to search on Instagram.
No,
I think people would search YouTube more. So I think if you're looking at, say, take testosterone replacement, I was having this conversation yesterday. If you're taking testosterone replacement therapy as an example, and you're searching that, chances are you might go on YouTube and, you know, type in your search categories into there, and you get a video, and you get informative videos and more educational videos, and then more long form content, you know, that 3 to 10 minute long tutorials on really trying to drive home educational value and how to do this, whether it's how to inject yourself, whether it's how to take a blood test, whether it's what do the blood test results mean. That sort of stuff lives perfectly as evergreen content on YouTube, whereas the conversations and the more fast-paced clickbait less than 1 minute sort of content that lives on your Instagrams and that lives on your TikToks. So I think it's about being aware of what type of content should live on what platform and how you can get your audience to kind of engage with it.
That makes sense. I had a really good question then and I just forgot about it. That doesn't normally happen to me. So when you were, that was it, when you were talking about testosterone. So I imagine many people listening have noticed that there are companies out there advertising for this. I'm not completely sure, but maybe the legislation changed in the last few years. I'm not completely sure around it. But what is the kind of so what about testosterone replacement therapy? Give us a bit of background. You know, if anyone's listening that has concerns, what can they do? Let's dig into it a bit.
Yeah, so it's one of those ones where a friend of mine that kind of created a business, and he kind of opened my eyes to this. And he was a sufferer himself, you know, had really sort of aggressive symptoms from a very young age, you know, which manifested itself in, you know, low libido, energy levels, terrible mood, you know, lack of motivation, you know.
Okay.
And he basically found out that he had clinically low testosterone in his early 20s.
Wow.
And that he then had a blood test, started treatment through a doctor, and his life turned around almost instantly.
Wow.
His, you know, so he, you know, all of the symptoms that he was really struggling with went away.
Like flicking a switch.
And he thought, how do people not know about this? He goes, the doctor was either going to give me antidepressants or start me on testosterone. And we went down the testosterone route, and it's changed his life. And so he set up a company which became, or is, the UK's largest service provider of testosterone replacement therapy, similar to what women would have with HRT and hormone replacement therapy for women. And it's one of those things where the statistics say that a quarter of men over the age of 40 could be clinically low in testosterone. And the first step to that is, you know, being aware of what the symptoms are and then, you know, testing to see via a blood test if you have, a level that is deemed clinically low. And if you do, you can be eligible for treatment, just like with any other sort of medicine.
And what were the NHS doing in and around this space around, because I don't know anything about this clinical pathway. So is it something that they've screened for or not really? Or like what's do you, and if you don't know, that's completely fine. I'm just curious.
No, it's, I think it's one of those ones where, and this is again, a very broad sweeping statement. I think the NHS are massively understaffed and under-resourced. Right. And, it's also not super high on the agenda for general practitioners. It's almost like a specialist niche, that sort of endocrinology side of things, which is, having a real good idea of blood and blood hormones. Mm. It's a very specialist skill set that not a lot of general practitioners have.
Yeah, I can
and
see that.
You put that in a framework that's under-resourced. And also just when it's not top of the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It often gets overlooked.
I wonder whether because a lot of the symptoms are symptoms of other things, which is actually something that happens in other clinical pathways, like polycystic ovary syndrome and endometriosis, a classic for this. And we've done shows on that before people start to think that I'm about to go and, talk about conditions that I don't have anything to do with. We've done shows on them. So the clinical leaders that have come onto the show have sort of been communicating about how it might be four or five symptoms that together the correctly trained clinician can identify as this. I wonder whether it's a bit of that with low testosterone. It could be depression. It could be low libido. It could be those things you mentioned.
Yeah, no, exactly. And a lot of the frustration from my point of view is that a lot of people just say, it's just getting older. Right? And it's almost like that acceptance of, sorry, buddy, you're over the age of 40. It's all downhill from here. And it's just that acceptance of this is the new normal for you when really it's not, and it doesn't have to be. And that a large chunk of the research is now saying that if you can maintain optimal hormonal levels of, specifically testosterone, that all markers go up, longevity improves, all-cause mortality decreases. Having low testosterone is a huge indicator that you will have a shorter and a less fruitful life.
Is that true? Is that actually true?
Yeah, there's a huge, massive medical study, which said that having clinically low testosterone increases mortality. So it's one of those things where if you can maintain the optimal levels and those, that nice broad band between, I think it's about 12 and 30 nanomoles per milliliter, that all of your life sort of indicators and longevity indicators will increase.
Because what we're talking about here before we go for the break, what we're talking about is just maintaining a healthy level of testosterone, right? We're not talking about trying to do anything wacky. We're just saying you can maintain a healthy level as you normally should have, then that helps your longevity.
Yeah, 100%. And that, a lot of the decreases in sort of health markers that we see as you age, can be attributed to that plummeting of natural levels of testosterone below that threshold.
Interesting. Well, let's pick this up to finish it off with the last part. And then I want to touch on a couple of other things around some of the stuff around your journey and how you see the future kind of panning out in the next 2 to 3 years. So we will be back in 2 minutes with the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Sean Stafford. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Sean Stafford. So, Sean, I remember seeing an article years and years and years ago, and it was years and years and years ago, of you had been brought on to train or as Spencer Matthews' personal trainer. But it was years ago.
A decade ago.
Yeah, it was like a long time ago. And I think he was still in like peak party boy phase or something. And it was like, I think the gist of the article was something like, I never knew I could get a six pack until I worked with Sean or something. I can't remember. There was like some nice line.
Sounds about right. As we were saying, it's very clickbaity.
It was a proper hook. Without wishing to breach any confidences or anything like that, but you're quite public on your profile about going with him. You went with him to the desert and things like that. He's doing some incredible stuff. Like, what kind of transformation have you seen there over the last 10 years? It must be insane.
Yeah, it's probably one of those things where, to put it into context, Men's Health, I think it was 10 years ago, were doing a celebrity six-pack challenge. And there was a pool of Made in Chelsea reality TV stars. And they'd all kind of been given to trainers. And Men's Health gave me a call, and I was just like, can you take this guy? Like, we think that you can
handle it.
You can handle him, pretty much. Like, I'm not sure. We don't know if there's anyone else that could handle him, because he's hard work.
Okay.
And that was a decade ago, and we worked together for 6 weeks getting him in shape to try and be on the cover of Men's Health.
Right.
And it was one of those ones where I was rocking up to his house at 7 a.m. and he was fast asleep. And, you know, he was just living that Made in Chelsea lifestyle, which, right, you know, over a decade ago was what he was doing.
Yeah.
But fast forward 10 years and he's a, you know, ultra endurance, Guinness World Record holding athlete, you know, has a really, you know, good relationship with sobriety.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a loving father of three, happily married man,
yeah,
business owner in the clean alcohol or the clean spirits, alcohol free yeah space. Sorry, my dad is,
that's okay. We don't mind having guests. It's okay. when you started working with him, can you extrapolate from that person to this person? Like, did you see it then, or did it take a while?
I'm just going to have to pause.
Yeah, you go
second.
Sort your dog out. Don't worry. We'll stay here for a second. If you've missed any of what Spencer Matthews is up to, I think a year ago took on the challenge of doing 30 consecutive marathons in the desert in Jordan in 30 days, which was a world record. So it was the longest consecutive number of marathons on sand, I believe. So, and you were just about to explain, like, whether or not back then you could extrapolate between the Spencer then and the Spencer now.
I think the underlying, I could see that he was an incredibly driven person, and that he almost had an underlying level of like classic addictive personality sort of traits.
Right.
And it was just about trying to lean into him and steer him in the way of making those habits more healthy and more having a positive impact in his life. And it was just one of those ones where I think it's something that he wanted. You know, he wanted to be in shape. He wanted to be fit. He wanted to be productive. And he's been very, very open about his relationship with alcohol and with drugs when he was younger and how it's literally been a full 180.
Yeah.
And, you know, now he is, you know, probably addicted to health, wellness, optimization, and running now. And, you know, when he came up with the idea of breaking a world record, a Guinness World Record of running 30 marathons in 30 days across the desert.
Yeah.
I thought he was crazy, but I kind of knew he could do it.
Right. And was it his idea? Was him just kind of noodling around?
Yeah. I think he's always looking for the opportunity to be great.
Okay.
Right. And it might come down from the fact that he lost his brother up Everest when he was very young.
Oh, wow.
He comes from a competitive, very competitive family, very successful family, but also just his want and his need to be the best version of himself, be an inspiration to, you know, his family, his friends, and you know, the millions of people that follow him online and a part of his community. So
yeah, it's amazing, the journey. And now he's going to go off and do this, the 7 Ironman distances, or you can't say Ironman, you have to say whatever you have to
Ironman
say.
Ironman distance triathlons.
Yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous. And in 7 continents, right? That's the plan.
That's the plan. So it has been done by one person in history, and it took 4 years.
Oh, okay. Seems like we can probably get under that.
Yeah. So I think the aim is to do it in 4 weeks.
Okay. Cool. That makes sense. I would imagine, like I've done an Ironman myself, I think the swim in Antarctica is going to be the toughest, I suspect.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when they're looking at, Spencer loves a nice bath more than the next man. He thinks he's a regular Wim Hof. But I think swimming a couple of kilometers in, freezing
Are they
water
going
will
to let him wear a
be.
wet? Are they going to let him wear a wetsuit? What's the rule?
Yeah, of course. I think so. Yeah, I think that's absolutely. I
That's
think you can
allowed.
wear a wetsuit. Yeah, I think you can wear a wetsuit in Ironman triathlons,
You
can't you?
can, yeah. I mean, no one's
Yeah.
ever done one in Antarctica, but there's no reason why you couldn't wear a wetsuit. That's going to be some thick kind of wetsuit, though. It's not. That's not going to be one of those swimming optimized ones, is it?
Correct. It might take him a bit longer, but I think he'd rather have that than extreme hypothermia.
Well, yeah. I mean, you've got some appendages that are going to be quite that you might not want to get frostbite on. Are you going to go out and do any of it, or it might be a bit too early?
No, I'll always try and dip in and dip out. I don't think I can legitimately take a month away from my
No.
life, but absolutely I can pop in for bits and pieces. I think I've done a marathon up Everest
Yeah, you did the Everest
back
one, didn't
in
you?
back in 2018, and then I did a desert marathon as part of Spencer's support crew
Yeah.
recently. So I think I've probably got one more in me, and I think
One
if I
more.
can, and if I can do the one on snow, so
Why don't you
if
do the
I can do the
180
Antarctic,
kilometer bike on snow? Why didn't you do that? That also sounds like a good
I think
idea.
I'll do the I think I'll do the I think I'll do the marathon on snow. If I can
Okay.
be there and not slow them down too much by doing a cheeky marathon in Antarctica, I think that would be a good three for me
That makes sense.
to hang up my
That's
hat on.
cool. That's going to be awesome. So we're into like the last 4 or 5 minutes of the show. So this type of section, I kind of open up a little bit to the with the guests around. Like, if you could give any advice or any thoughts to anyone that's kind of starting their own business or thinking about what they're going to do or embarking on their own health journey, or like, what kind of advice do you wish you'd have gotten when you were younger? Or I don't know, how do you want to sort of, what kind of, mottos or missions do you sort of align yourself to that have gotten you through some of these crazy difficult times, which, I mean, any business owner goes through difficult times. So I don't know, what do you, anything come to mind?
Yeah, I would say over-index on positivity. So I think it is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you constantly say how stressed you are and constantly say how tough it is, all of a sudden you will become really stressed and it will feel really tough. Whereas I think if you can surround yourself with good people that are we call it GVO. Like we don't hire anybody at City Athletic who's not GVO, and GVO quite simply is good vibes only. At 6 in the morning, you bring
Bring the
positivity at
vibes.
9 p.m. at night, 9 p.m. at night, you bring positivity. And it's one of those things, I think if you can create an infrastructure and support network around you that is really positive and can always have a can-do attitude, don't come with problems, come with problems and solutions. And it's one of those ones where I think if you're really leaning into that, let's find a way to do this, let's find a way to make this possible. And also being nimble. I think whenever I've worked with big companies, whether it on a brand ambassador role or even, a little bit more behind the scenes, I think a lot of the power that one, two small, one, two man band or small, medium sized companies, I think their biggest power is their ability to be nimble and agile, and as long as you've got that resilience to take a punch in the gut and keep moving forward, I think as companies scale, they lose that. And I think that's a real superpower of sort of that really small to medium sized business. And I think entrepreneurs really need to lean into that. They need to be dynamic. They need to have a dynamic team around them, and they need to, be really focused on what they're delivering, whether it's a service, whether it's a product, and who their customers are. It's, being able to talk and fill a need for your customers is the number one route to success. And if you can do it with a smile on your face, then it makes it a much more pleasurable experience.
That is definitely true. You know what? I'm so pleased you said that thing about being a bit about being stressed. Because so, we had half term a couple of weeks ago, obviously quite busy, and then I got back last week, and my kids had been sick on half term, so they'd basically been coughing in my own open mouth.
Fantastic.
And then I got sick last week, and so I felt like I took 2 weeks off, and then you know, I've been feeling kind of stressed. But do you know what, even just hearing that sort of rebased me and sort of made me realize that actually the more that you talk about being stressed, the more often that you do get stressed.
No, 100%. Like, I'm a big believer in you create your own sort of ecosystem and energy levels. Like, you know, I always say to my guy, you know, be the change you want to see. And if you want to see people being more positive, and you want to see people being more generous and more kind, and, you know, cutting people some slack and being supportive to people, that starts with you. As in, you know, you can only be responsible for what you're putting out there. And if you can be a role model, or be the guy that's on the front foot being that change that you want to see, chances are there'll be people that follow you.
I think that's really important. I do think that there's a lot of people out there, or it's very easy to sort of point the finger at people and say, oh, I think you should be doing this or doing that. And then actually you're not doing the same thing. So what's your, to go back a bit to the issue around the sobriety, the dispensers relationship, where are you with this? So I go through periods of total sobriety. So I'm in one right now. So I go no alcohol, no coffee, no caffeine at all. So like, what's your, cause you've been, you must've been through periods where you've been completely off it, but I, you know, I don't know, where do you sort of stand on it?
Well, you probably, I don't know if you can remember university, cause you were quite drunk all the time, but you probably remember, you probably, like, I wasn't a huge drinker at university, even, was I? I was a bit of a boring square. So I've never had a really high tolerance or enjoyment for alcohol. I've never really found that it brings much to the party for me. Like, it doesn't make me more charismatic. It doesn't make me smarter. It doesn't make me more relaxed. It doesn't do anything apart from, you know, bring some level of anxiety and a headache the next day. So I kind of had a, you know, bit of an epiphany moment a couple of years ago where I got really drunk the night before a load of really big meetings. We had a successful sort of part of a company I'm involved with. They had a really good investment, and we went out to celebrate, and it ended up in, you know, a lot of Aperol spritzes and a couple of bottles of champagne. But I'd flown halfway across the world to host a load of meetings the following day, and I was a complete waste of space.
Okay.
And at that point in time, I thought, you know what, I never need to do that again.
Yeah.
It doesn't align with who I want to be.
Sure.
And so I don't drink, really.
Oh, nice.
I drink a lot of alcohol-free alternatives.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm also not one of those guys that if somebody offers me a glass of champagne on their birthday, I would say no.
Yeah, so right. So that, but that's a healthy yeah. I think that's a healthy relationship with it. Well, look, Sean, that was awesome. Great show. That's the end. So thank you very much for coming on.
Amazing. Thank you for having me.
And thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show. So thanks a lot for being here.